From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media and WBFO, this is What's Next, Producer's Picks. Highlights of conversations heard on previous episodes. On today's show,
people largely think about either training a person for a job or helping them find a job and placing them in a job. But the piece of workforce development that's often forgotten is how do you help the person keep the job?
Community and Public Relations Director for Evans Bank, Kathleen Rizzo-Young, and the President and CEO of United Way Buffalo, Trina Burris. And we close out with...
I'm a social worker by education. I've been a social worker for 17 years. I do that because I firmly believe and know that all people have the real ability to change their lives, to transform, to improve, to become better. And at the EOC, I see that every day.
Executive Director of Buffalo Educational Opportunity Center at the University of Buffalo, Ben Hillegas. I'm Dallas Taylor. First, we revisit Jay Moran's conversation with Kathleen Rizzo-Young from Evans Bank and Trina Burris of United Way of Buffalo. The two discuss Work-Life Solutions, a program dedicated to improving workplace productivity, retention, the well-being of employees, and more.
Great to have you back, and we have a lot to talk about this. Work-Life Solutions, who wants to take it first? Just break it down. What exactly are we talking about here? Because there's a lot inside this program, but just a general overview to start.
Sure. So what I'll say, Jay, is that when you think about workforce development, people largely think about either training a person for a job or helping them find a job and placing them in a job. But the piece of workforce development that's often forgotten is how do you help the person keep the job? And so Work-Life Solutions is the United Way workforce development program that helps folks keep the job. And frankly, you know, wherever you are in your employment journey, it's also a place where as you are living life, there's some help there for you to balance work and life. Ergo Work-Life Solutions.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because when we talk about the United Way, we're always thinking about the ways that organization has, in legendary fashion, helped community members in a lot of different aspects. So you're bringing that resource into the workplace for these companies that are participating in this?
Sure. So when you think about United Way, we really have a unique Rolodex, right? Because of the things that we do, the ways that we do it. So we have access to a lot of information, whether or not it's local information or whether or not it's national information. We just know things, right? And so a program like Work-Life Solutions, there is no nonprofit that's better situated to use its natural resources, if you will, to help members of the community, which is ultimately our goal.
And speaking of resources, this program, Work-Life Solutions, was utilized by a couple of other United Way agencies, if I'm not mistaken, beyond Buffalo and Erie County. And that's basically how it came to be here.
Yes, because, you know, locally at United Ways across the country, but certainly here at our local United Way, we are always looking for opportunities and best practices that we're seeing across our worldwide network. And we are always asking ourselves, would this be good for our community? Should we bring it here? And very often the answer is yes, but it has to sit on the shelf until we can figure out the resources, the staffing, and all of this. But, you know, because we always want to be on the ready, we're always thinking, and that's always sitting on the shelf. And that's been United Way's history long before I came. So 5 years ago, 6 years ago or so, Work-Life Solutions was sitting on the shelf waiting.
And our CEO at Evans Bank, Dave Naska, we had gotten an unexpected tax break 6 years ago. And he said, this is an opportunity for us as a community bank, you know, relatively small organization, to make a big impact. And so he went around and met with many, many community leaders from the philanthropy world, from nonprofits, from agencies to say, is there a program that we need here that we don't have?
Okay.
And nobody really had a good answer until he got to New United Way. And they said, yes, we have this wonderful workforce program, financial wellness at work is what the program are called around the country. And they said, we wanted to do it for a long time. And so we went to Ohio and looked at the program there. And there was a conference taking place where a lot of different United Ways from across the country were there to start their own programs. And we immediately said, this is a great fit. And so we've been involved ever since, very, very deeply involved in the program and really in a partnership with United Way that's been tremendously gratifying.
And before,
so the way, oh, God, the way, I was just going to say, the way the program is set up with this resource coordinator, right, who's assigned to the employer, and that's the resource, that person becomes like a de facto member of their team.
All right.
Everybody knows them in the company. You might have their phone number in your phone. You might be able to text them, whatever it is. But
how often would they be at a company?
Weekly?
Weekly?
Yeah, okay. It depends. And the
but
nice
they're
thing,
always available by
they're
phone.
They're always okay. available. All so right. Yeah. And the great thing about it is you now have an answer to the question to say, if you're having trouble at work, go to HR. But if you're having trouble outside of work that's impeding your ability to persist in the workplace, to do your job, to focus, and maybe it's not about you, maybe it's about somebody in your family, right, you can go see the Work-Life Solutions Resource Coordinator and they are going to help you. And that's a huge safety net, you know, in the workplace.
And what I was going to ask, and you'd gone into a little more of the specifics of the program, but you know, when we talk about some of the issues that employers are having keeping employees, it seems like the general thought is, well, they're not paying enough, there's not job satisfaction. But what it seems to me that this program is addressing and highlighting is the fact that there's a lot of other things that go on where people are, they're dealing with, you know, an existential questions, for lack of a better term, in their lives. You know, whether it's, you know, let's talk about what are some of those issues that we're seeing with some of these employees that are finding their way into Work-Life Solutions.
Yeah, the list is unfortunately long, Jay, but it's diverse. Mm-hmm. I mean, it goes from, you know, there was an individual whose spouse was a diabetic and they had all these used needles and needed to know how to, okay, like where to discard them, right?
Sure.
So it's all the way from that to gambling issues, to housing instability, help with eviction court, utilities, car repairs, mental health.
Addicted family members. Yeah. Putting parents in nursing homes who need more help.
Ooh, yes.
Trying to find resources for, you know, a family member who's ill. And as Trina said, the list is so long. And that is democratic. It appeals to everybody. It doesn't
right.
matter if you're the CEO of that company or if you're, you know, an entry-level person. It's everybody has these issues. And everybody, you know, you said people leave jobs they love every day because of these things.
Right.
That was the wake-up call for all of us. I think one of the things that we found that's been really exciting as we started to gather data for the program over the years is the intersection between this program and the ALICE population that United Way is so focused on, right? Mm-hmm. So that even though the program helps everybody across the spectrum, you think about people in that category, and I'll let Trina talk about ALICE, but I think you think about people that have maybe no family support here. Maybe we have the kind of new Americans population. We have, you know, Buffalo is kind of such a wonderful melting pot. We have people who don't have a safety net or a support network.
Right.
So when they start a job, you know, what are the resources they have? So we've been really happy to see as we help people that it's really been the people who are the neediest in some respects with this program.
ALICE population?
So ALICE, it's an acronym. It stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Employed.
Okay.
Right. And so these are folks who in our county, the data says it's 40% of our community.
Wow.
So the ALICE population are individuals, workers. So that's important. Workers who have jobs that are critically important. We would even call them good jobs. Mm-hmm. People would describe some of these jobs as good jobs. However, these individuals do not have enough money to not need the governmental safety nets, but because of the federal poverty line, they make too much money,
mm-hmm,
right, to receive the safety nets that they may need. And so when you think about food insecurity, you think about housing instability, transportation needs, there are all kinds of safety nets out there, but these folks are making too much money to receive them. And so a program like Work-Life Solutions, despite the fact anybody could use it, it's most helpful to that population because they may not believe that they have any access to a system
all right.
where they could
receive some help. That's what you're finding? Your resource counselors are finding
yes.
that?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. 1,000%. There's a employee at United Way who once told me if it weren't for Work-Life Solutions, they would have to take a family leave. And I said, for what? Because they need to take care of an ailing parent.
Right.
Think about that.
Right.
A person at United Way right? This person has, you would easily say, couldn't be understated, how much access to information a United Way employee has. And yet, because we are also a work-life solutions employer, right? We provide it as a benefit.
So then I was going to say, so the interesting thing is, so that we have the resource coordinator, we have the financial education, and then the third component of the program is a $1,000 loan,
right?
And what's interesting about that loan is that people can get access to it within 48 hours, sometimes 24. Our team is really, really good.
$1,000 loan.
$1,000 loan.
With it, 24
and
to 48
so they
hours.
Have to be at the company or their employer for a year. But after that, no questions asked. Nobody says, what do you need it for? We want to know that for our own research and for our data. But there's not a checklist, or you're not getting approved for something. You come in and you have that money. And that $1,000 loan has been, we've made over 725 of those loans in the last 5 years to people working for these companies and nonprofits. And the great thing about this is that it not only helps them in the immediate need, because we knew that, right? We knew somebody said, you know, it can be anything from, you know, uncovered medical expenses or the eviction, or I have to make a mortgage payment, I'm short, or something like that, whatever it is. And car is a big one. Car repairs are always huge. But what we found over time was, when you've taken out a work-life solutions loan and after it's paid back, Jay, through payroll deduction by your employer.
Okay.
So the great thing about that when you think about it is we know we're going to be paid back, right? So there's no collateral. So that gives the employee who borrows that money every month that's being paid back, $100 a month. And every month on their credit report, they're getting an on-time credit payment, right? That's helping their credit score. In some cases, it's helping them establish credit because some of these folks don't have any credit. So that's a huge piece too, but they're getting credit. They see the impact of their credit score going up and up and up. And that was an eye-opener to us when we did the research to say we had people who had taken out successive work-life solutions loan whose credit scores had increased 150 points.
Wow.
That's life-changing, right?
Yeah, that's life-changing.
Right. That means I can become a homeowner. I can, you know, all these different things that, you know, we have people who, you know, had never been in a bank branch before they come in to get their $1,000. They had never, because their impression was to, as Trina just said, kind of, I don't have enough money that a bank would be interested in me, or that I'm bankable, or that they would want me. And it's like they get to come in, they get this warm greeting, they get their $1,000, and it's like, what else do you need? What else is going on in your life? Are there other ways we can help you? And suddenly, folks have a bank. They have a banker. They have people who know them by name when they come in. That's really can also be a huge part of this generational wealth building and people feeling like I'm part of the mainstream. And as bankers, like, you know, that's really exciting to us.
I'm interested to find out a little bit more about the resource counselors and how much can they advocate inside the employer for the employees. We talked about how they can connect to a lot of different opportunities or resources in the community, but can they? Do they have an ability to advocate on behalf of the employee who's bringing their issues to them but not going to human resources?
So there's a fine line.
Sure.
Each employer, it's a little different depending on what the partnership is with the employer. So a critical part of the relationship with the resource coordinator is there is confidentiality first and foremost.
All right.
So the resource coordinator never goes to the HR department and says, just so you know, you know, it's not that.
Gotcha.
The way the advocacy happens is that quarterly, the resource coordinator and the program manager at United Way, they sit down with the CEO and the head of HR and they talk about data.
All right.
And so they might say to the employer, we've served X number of your employees over the course of this quarter. And here are some of the issues that they are dealing with. And it's not about specificity of the issues. We try to make them in big buckets, right? So we'll say housing instability. We won't say one of your employees is homeless, right? Mm-hmm. So we're trying to advocate, to use your word, we're trying to draw a picture for the employer to let them know, listen, your employees have a lot going on, right? And so, but on the other hand, at some employers, the employers are so embedded in Work-Life Solutions, that if they have an employee that's in HR for the typical reasons employee would be interacting with HR, the HR department will say, you need to go and talk to one of the resource coordinators if it is that, you know, there are issues going on outside. Right. So we don't just want, because employers pay for this service, right? We don't just want employers who are just writing the check and expecting that the program sits on the shelf. It's not a sit on the shelf kind of program, right? It's the hands on, it's the sports car, right? Like you want it to perform. That is where the advocacy takes place.
I do. It's interesting. I have a story about that, which was an employer who signed up for the program the first year. And the reason that he signed up for it was he said, I think of my employees as my kids, as my family, my extended family, and I don't like my kids to rent. And so he said, I want to get my employees to be homeowners. So I think this program will help them do that. And so he was very upfront with us. We said, well, you know, we'll we offer a homeownership training as part of, you know, some of our financial education classes. But when we asked, you know, the employees what they want, their needs were so basic. And when we gave him the first assessment of the people that we had seen at his company and the kinds of issues they were dealing with, to Trina's point, just as raw, you know, just saying, here's the number. Okay. He got all teared up. He said, I brought you in here thinking my people needed housing. And he said, and these are the issues they're dealing with every day when they come in with a smile on their face. He said, and I thought I was this engaged boss who, you know, was friends with my staff and knew everything. And he said, I was absolutely clueless of the level of things, the trauma, the things they were dealing with on an everyday basis, because they come in and they do their work and they're so dedicated to the company. And it was a aha moment for him to say, I was clueless. So now they have this resource, they have someone to help them. And it was really eye-opening. And he's been a wonderful advocate for the program, telling other CEOs, you know, you might think you know your folks and you might think you know what they need, but you know, if you're like me, you really don't know. There's a wall there. There's a wall.
You also, I think you use the terms that you have to kind of anticipate community needs to a certain extent. But I'm curious, you know, anticipating needs. What's kind of on the radar right now?
So right now, what we're thinking about with Work-Life Solutions is how can we expand the program, not in terms of just adding employers and more employees, right, which is important to do, but how can we add value, and what kind of data are we seeing in other places in our work that'll point what we should be doing next?
Okay.
So we're thinking about, can we bring fresh fruits and vegetables to the employer sites? Can we have this amazing series that we did called You Belong, where community members are coming in and reading books, and we put it up on our YouTube channel, right? And the beauty of that is that if your parent is working two jobs, they may not have time to read the book, right? But even my three-year-old granddaughter can pick up her laptop or her tablet and watch whatever she wants to watch. And so we're saying, can we bring books for employees to be able to take home to their children so that they, you know, they create a library at home? And we're also thinking about, so remember with the loan, the key is you have to be 1 year and an employee in good standing. Well, the most vulnerable time in the life of an employee is that first year.
Right.
Because you've got a probationary period. Now with people working remotely, maybe you haven't developed relationships and all this stuff. So there's a vulnerability in that first year. Well, because you're not eligible for the loan, we don't have a way right now to respond if the real issue is just cash. You just need $1,000. So we're thinking, how can we bring our community resilience program into work life to help in that 1 year, so that if it is about repairing your tire so that you can get to work, can we give you a grant for $1,000? Or, you know, can we figure out a way by talking with our friends here at the bank? How can we have people repay it so that we always have the slush fund, you know, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think one of the things is, too, as you look at what's happening in employment right now and how employers are desperate to find and keep good people.
Absolutely.
And they want that advantage of like, what's the extra thing that we can do?
Right. Looking for the edge.
What's the edge? What are we going to provide for our employees? That I think has been very, very much to the benefit of Work-Life Solutions, where people are looking for creative additions to their employee benefits program. And this is about as creative as you can get, right?
Right.
It really is, to say, wait a minute, we offer this program. And we've had people say, you know, well, I got a job offer, but the company I interviewed for doesn't have Work-Life Solutions. Honestly, that's how important this program becomes to people,
right,
is that they really think this is something that's really important to me and my family. I think one of the things we thought about when we need to talk about to you about today is, you know, we always say to CEOs, you know, look into this program and check it out. But also, I guess we would encourage the average employee to say, if you don't have this program at your workplace, maybe ask about it, or maybe ask your HR department to look into it. The cost is very manageable, and it's something that allows the employer to really demonstrate a level of commitment to their employees that's really, really above the norm.
You know, we've used the term and resource counselor, but we haven't really talked about the type of person or people that are filling these roles. They sound like they carry a heavy load.
They're great folks. There's three of them. So they're a small team, but they are mighty. They have interesting backgrounds. One person has sort of a social work nonprofit background. Another person has a nonprofit background. Another person is also a retired banker that has some nonprofit background. So they have very interesting collective life experiences. There are two men and one woman. Because they're able to work as a team and they sit right there together, you know, if there were someone, despite the fact one resource coordinator may be assigned to one very specific employer, if it is that there's a client that would feel more comfortable speaking to a woman, or somebody be more comfortable speaking to a man, the diversity in the team is there, so we can respond, any way we need to. And it's a role that a lot of people in the community don't know about us.
Yeah.
Right? They don't think of us.
When you think about United Way in the workplace, you don't think about this,
no.
Right?
That's not what you think about.
No, it's running away from that little card that is in your envelope, in your mailbox.
That's right.
And this is a game changer. The companies and the employers that have this program think very differently about the United Way. The United Way is helping me in my life every day. Like, it's just a different paradigm. So for United Way to... Not only what we were excited about at Evans about this program was because United Way is now, you know, has a fee for service program. Somebody, an employer is writing a check to United Way, and that's a different kind of revenue stream for them, which we loved.
Sure.
But also because it changed the way people thought about United Way. They thought about United Way now as the answer to their issues. And we like, that's the thing we're so proud of, is that it helps people think about the organization. I'm a board member of United Way, and as a board member, I'm excited by that, to have people think about United Way in this new way as the solution to what's happening in their lives. That's, you know, that's really huge.
What about, we've got 13 employers right now?
13 right now. Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you're actively looking for more.
For sure.
How do you make that connection? Maybe there's an employer who's listening right now.
That would be great.
That would be fantastic. So there's a Work-Life Solutions link on our United Way website, the uwbec.org website. You can call the United Way. If there is someone in your company that's affiliated with United Way, they can send us an email. And it's a program we love to talk about.
I can say from the standpoint of Evans, you know, we've been around over 100 years, and our CEO and our company, we're so proud of our involvement with this program. You know, he often says, like, this is the best thing I think we've done from a philanthropy standpoint, from a community standpoint. You know, it just combines everything. It combines financial wherewithal and wealth building and, you know, bringing things into the workplace that help people persist and help them keep their jobs. And so on so many different points, it's such a marvelous program. And we're, you know, we love talking about it. But that's the great news about it, is that as it's grown, you know, every month there's something new that's, you know, kind of shows itself to be another great aspect of the program, another benefit of it.
That was Kathleen Rizzo-Young from Evans Bank and Trina Burris of United Way of Buffalo. We close today's show with Ben Hillegas from the University at Buffalo. He speaks on his first year in his role as executive director and what plans he has entering his second year in the role.
I guess when we were talking, when we first had you on, you were on the job about 7 days.
That's correct, Jay. Thank you so much for having me back. It's a real pleasure to be back here with you. It was somewhat of a painful exercise, but I re-listened to the original appearance yesterday.
They were more painful for me, but that's another story.
No, not at all. You were great. I realized I was kind of playing with house money because I was only on the job for 2 weeks. But at this point, I probably need to know what I'm talking about. So we'll see how that goes.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I think it's interesting because, I mean, just overall, and well, maybe we just talk about the EOC just a little bit to get into it, just the overview of it, and then we can go back into it for those few people who didn't hear the first episode between us.
Absolutely. So the Buffalo EOC has been around for 51 years at this point. It was founded by Arthur O. Eve. He spearheaded legislation that created both the Educational Opportunity Center program as well as the Educational Opportunity Program, which is EOP. So at that point, 51 years ago, there was 4 EOCs across New York State. Over the last 51 years, that system has grown to include 12. So there are EOCs in Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, the Capital District, the 5 boroughs, and Westchester and Long Island. Each one of those EOCs is affiliated with a SUNY institution in their community. For us, it's the University of Buffalo. Downstate, it's CUNY. There are community colleges. There are state colleges. But we have a wonderful relationship with the University of Buffalo. I actually report to the provost, and he and his office are incredibly supportive of the Buffalo EOC, which we appreciate a great deal. And what we do at the Buffalo Educational Opportunity Center is provide free vocational and educational programs to members of our community. There is eligibility requirements, primarily financial eligibility requirements. So anyone who qualifies for public assistance automatically qualifies. And then we accept folks who are up to 250% of the poverty line. And we serve this year, we're on track to serve about 1,200 students by the end of our academic calendar, which will be at the end of June. And we provide GED, ESOL. We provide academic foundational review courses, which is kind of a backbone of all of the programming because we work to get people up to a level where they can take advantage of other opportunities. And then we have a relatively broad range of vocational training programs that we are adding to and that I'd like to talk about later.
Sure. And it's interesting just to hear you mention it. People are eligible if they're, up to 250% of the poverty level here. Unfortunately, I would think that includes a tremendous amount of people.
Absolutely. I mean, we all know that, you know, Buffalo has disproportionate levels of poverty as compared to other cities. And, I mean, there's a lot of eligible people, and we are very happy to serve all of those folks.
All right, let's get into some of the programs. You came in with a fresh set of eyes. That must have been interesting in its own regard. I mean, maybe even kind of take a look back. You came in looking at it when we talked back in June the last year, a certain way, what you saw then, what you see now. What are some of the differences that you see?
It's a great question. I mean, one of the things I have learned over the course of this almost year is just, and really it reinforced things that I kind of already knew. How essential the EOC is. I mean, I have just seen firsthand how absolutely foundational it is to a lot of the things that happen in our community, which I knew, but just seeing it firsthand and being a part of it really has reinforced that. And then,
when you say you knew, I mean, what did you understand about it?
Well,
I mean, you were at the Matt Urban Center, so you know
Matt
what it's like dealing with.
When I was at the Matt Urban Center, but more specifically, my many years working in youth services.
Okay.
And I had been involved in juvenile justice in Erie County and was pretty connected to the EOC because there were a lot of young people that we worked with in family court, okay, in probation, in detention, who needed an alternative setting, right? And the EOC provided that for them. So I was very familiar. But again, you never know until you're actually
right inside.
Right inside. And then just, you know, the breadth of all of the things that we do to support folks became more apparent. And it's just been reinforced almost on a daily basis since I started. Just, again, how essential it is to so many aspects of what happens in this community. And then the second thing is the resilience of people, the resilience of our students. I mean, the stories that I have heard from our students individually and then what I have seen them achieve in the short time that I've been there. I'm a social worker by education. I've been a social worker for 17 years. I do that because I firmly believe and know that all people have the real ability to change their lives, to transform, to improve, to become better. And at the EOC, I see that every day. And it just, again, reinforces that knowledge that people are so resilient, especially people here in Buffalo.
So I love to hear stories. And I think you like to talk about the success stories, and I'm sure there are many, but maybe let's just touch upon some folks that you've encountered and how maybe you've seen quick changes or real dramatic changes in individuals.
It's a great question. I mean, there's quick changes and there's also long changes.
Sure, right? Of course.
There's folks who come to the EOC who have been coming to the EOC for 3, 4, 5 years, right, working on their GED, and remain persistent in doing it and struggle for a variety of reasons to be able to achieve it, but keep coming and stay connected to their instructors and take advantage of the opportunities that we provide that are outside of the classroom, you know, whether it's tutoring or other support services. And one thing about the GED is that you can take each of the subject areas independently. You can walk into a GED testing center and just take your math portion.
Okay.
You don't have to take them all at the same time. And as you pass the math portion, you're done. You've passed that math portion, you never have to do it again. So we actually, starting in January, we introduced a new GED model. Most GED programs, you are reviewing all four subject areas, math, science, history, and reading. You're reviewing them all at the same time, right? And then you're sitting down and taking the test. It's overwhelming, and it can be a lot for a lot of people. So if you sit down and take the GED and you pass two sections, you don't pass the other two, then you're good with the two
okay.
that you passed. So then people go back into another review class, and they're taking everything again, and they're taking, you know, more content related to the sections that they've already passed. So we've now broken it up. We are giving people the opportunity to come in and just review math and then just take their math portion, or just take science and just take their science portion. And it just allows them to do it in more bite-sized chunks and, you know, demonstrate success and then build on that success. And a lot of those people, several of them, who've been with us for 3 or 4 or 5 years and have struggled, are now having success with that model.
That's great.
It's incredible. It's exactly what we anticipated. We didn't make it up. We based it off of...
I was going to ask that. Yeah. Did you learn from one of the other EOCs?
That's precisely right. We
yeah.
learned from the Manhattan EOC, who started doing this a couple of years ago, and they had data. They had evidence that it was successful, that their completion rates were increasing and that folks were having more success. So actually, both our relationship with the Manhattan EOC and then our relationship with the SUNY Office of Academic and Workforce Development, which oversees and administers EOCs, helped us to implement this program. And we're just thrilled with the results. So that's one example of the changes
right.
I've seen. Without getting into details, I mean, I've spoken to a handful of folks. We have many folks at the EOC who are
sure.
immigrants and refugees.
Okay.
But I've had some pretty detailed conversations with a few of them. And, you know, we have people at the EOC who are taking vocational programs, fulfilling kind of lifelong dreams, who've spent up to 20 years in refugee camps in various parts throughout the world. Which is, I mean, it's very difficult, I think, for you or I to really comprehend or understand what that experience would be like. I mean, a year, 2 years, 5 years, but 20 years in a refugee
right.
camp, and then to come to this country and have to start over completely and find themselves at a place like the EOC where they've learned English, where they have increased their skills in some academic subject areas and taken a vocational training program in a field that is something that they always aspired to, where they're going to get an entry-level job, but a good entry-level job. And then, you know, there are people who are middle-aged, you know, later in life, who have told me, like, I always wanted to be a nurse, right? Never thought it was possible.
Mm.
But I've seen some of these people who are now, you know, not that far away from possibly being able to achieve that dream. You know, there's more school ahead of them. There's more commitment that has to be made. But I can see that now they actually believe that that's possible because of the success that they've had. And, I mean, it's probably the most gratifying thing I can imagine, knowing that folks who have had those experiences, who have had those, you know, just unthinkable challenges in their life, are now in a place where they may be able to achieve a dream that they've had for decades that they didn't think was attainable.
It's obviously great to see that they're getting to that next level. I'm curious, though, just trying to, you know, get to the core of things. I know in the Buffalo Public Schools, for example, when they're dealing with their student population of whether, you know, immigrant or refugee children coming in, and one of the big issues is just determining where they can place people you know, how they can, you know, what levels they can start at. So how do you go about, how does your center go about figuring out, okay, you know, somebody's coming, like you said, they could be, maybe they lived here, they were in a refugee camp for 20 years or whatever the case may be. How do you go through finding out? That sounds like it's got to be its own problem.
That's a great question. We spend a lot of time on assessment for all of the people who come through our doors. And immigrants and refugees and people who are non-native English speakers have a very specific assessment that they go through. It's a very interesting question, though, Jay, because it is a place where we are evolving. There are multiple levels of English as a second language courses that people can take, but there's also a level, like a pre-level. There's a level one, level two, level three, but then there's a large group of people who don't fit into any of those three categories because they may have low literacy in their own language, right? So the assessment becomes difficult, and the ability to teach them even at the most introductory level is limited because of their low literacy in their native language.
Right. And
there's not a lot of programs or interventions for people who are coming in at that level. So we are actually, we did a few things. In January, in addition to launching the new GED program, we also launched some additional courses and sections of ESL. Number one, because there is a lot of demand out there right now, and we needed to increase our capacity so we could welcome more students, but also because we needed to address these people who are being assessed below the most basic level. So it is evolving. What we did initially was we created a lab, like an open enrollment lab that we offered in the evening. So folks could walk in at any time throughout the quarter or the semester, and we would immediately place them in the lab, which is not always the case for a course that's, you know, happening over the course of a quarter, seven and a half weeks. Once the course closes, it's pretty much closed, and you wouldn't want to throw somebody in there. So this is an open enrollment lab where they get more individual one-on-one tutoring, and you're really kind of teaching the basics. You're teaching, you know, how to read a clock, how to, you know, have a financial transaction at a store, things like that. But it's just more individualized, more one-on-one, trying to build up that capacity. So we did that in January. We did it because it was the best we could do at the time. We wanted to be able to capture these people, and we wanted to be able to start building up their skills and abilities. But our chief academic person at the EOC has just completed a new program proposal that they're submitting to SUNY, specifically for pre-basic level.
Yep.
Based on input and feedback that we've got from SUNY, the chief academic person at the office that we work with at SUNY has extensive experience in ESL. They were an ESL teacher. So we've developed a very intentional, very specific program for folks who are coming in at these pre-levels, and we'll be implementing that, if not in the summer, in the fall. It's just part of this broader strategy of really... I told you before we got on the air, like the initial approach when I started for the first, let's say, 6 months was to make sure we were doing what we already do as well as we can and doing as much of it as we can. So the GED and the ESL enhancement and expansion is just what's occurred through January and now, you know, ongoing into the fall. Examples of that. And I'm very happy with how much more capacity we've been able to add in the innovative new programs, and it's helping to better serve our students and give them more options and give us more options to better meet their individual needs when they come through our door.
We're speaking with Ben Hillegas today on what's next, the executive director of the EOC here in Buffalo. It's interesting to hear how, when we start talking, like you said, these, when you put levels of literacy in, we're talking about somebody who's trying to learn English as a second language, and you start really considering the complications involved. It shows kind of that how, I guess, flexible and nimble your staff has to be when it comes to addressing the needs of the students who are showing up.
It's a very astute observation, Jay, because I use the word flexible all the time when I'm talking to partners and people who are, you know, learning about the EOC. I think we're designed to be flexible. We're designed to be adaptive because the needs of the community change so frequently. We're positioned to be able to move quickly and adapt and change to meet those needs. So I love that you said that, because it really is something that I reiterate time and time again. But it's something that I've absorbed and learned in my year at the OC.
Like, right.
We have that flexibility. When a partner comes to us and says, you know, we've identified this need in the community, we have this evidence to support that this is something that we should do, we want to implement this particular program, we have A, B, and C, do you have D and E, right?
Right.
And if I don't, although oftentimes we do, I can say we can do that because of the flexibility that we're afforded by just the way the EOCs are set up.
It's interesting because you mentioned the partners bringing this need to your attention, or perhaps a need that they didn't know that the EOC already had been taken care of. But you did talk to me a little bit before we went on there about the different partnerships that you've seen and experienced since you've been there in this less than a year. What about this? So let's just take an example then. Okay, a partner who comes in. All right, they say, here's a need in the community. What might that be? And, you know, how then do you adjust?
So there's a lot of examples. I'll just pick one relatively at random. So the Kensington Project, right?
Ah.
Which is controversial in its own right. But I think we all recognize at this point that something is going to happen at some point in the
relative. A large scale construction project, right?
Mm-hmm. $1 billion price tag on a large scale construction project in Buffalo on the east side, that hopefully repairs harm that was done, you know, decades ago, by poor or, you know, intentionally malicious policy choices.
We'll save that tangent for another conversation. Yes.
So the Department of Transportation, New York State DOT, has in the past worked with the Syracuse EOC on the I-81 project,
right,
which is very similar to the Kensington Project in Buffalo. Another, you know, expressway built through the middle of a city that they want to tear down in order to, you know, reconnect people and have a different kind of transportation network in the city. So because of what EOCs do and the nature of EOCs, the DOT worked with Syracuse years ago and ongoing today to stand up a kind of a basic introductory road construction training program.
Oh, all right.
That is occurring in Syracuse now. It's been very successful. They came to us related to the Kensington Project and said, hey, we're working with Syracuse on this program. Would you be able to do something similar? Would you be able to replicate a road construction program that Syracuse is doing? When I started, I knew I wanted to get back into trades. The EOC in the past had a very large portfolio of trades programs. We know how much need there is in the community to fill, you know, all sorts of construction jobs. So it was a missed opportunity for the OC not to be involved in trades. So already wanted to do it. DOT approaches us. It's a relatively basic program, 6.5 to 7 weeks, getting people prepared to be able to get jobs on with contractors on road construction jobs.
Wow.
So we are in development of that right now. So in terms of partnership, it's DOT,
sure,
right? It's the Syracuse EOC that's providing us with resources and information, curriculum, all of that stuff. We're very excited about the DOT project, first of all. And our intention is to get this program up and running by the summertime. July or August, we'll hopefully launch our first cohort. We'll be promoting it quite a bit. We'll be recruiting. It'll be something that you'll probably see somewhere out there, either on social media or billboards or signs or flyers. And it's our first foray back into trades, and it's really exciting. And because of the nature of the Kensington Project, like, in my opinion, no matter what happens, the most important thing is that people from the impacted communities are able to in some way benefit from the construction
project. Right, because there has been a criticism, and it's been aired on this show, that, you know, I'll try to quote it as best. It's a jobs project in an impoverished neighborhood for white people. And there, I think, is some truth to that when you look at some of the local trades here. I don't want to overgeneralize and be, you know, criticized for that. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of truth to that. So you're saying there's an opportunity through the EOC to connect more people to more opportunities, and opportunities that pay pretty good money on these construction jobs.
Prevailing wage, yes, and really are also a pathway, an on-ramp to jobs in construction fields,
sure.
Right? Like a career. So we could take people who have no construction experience and get them ready to get on one of these road crews, hopefully earn prevailing wage for as long as the project goes on, and then use that as a springboard to continue in construction trades into the future and have a career. So that's the way we're looking at it. And I give DOT a lot of credit. They're being very intentional about this. They want to do this for the reasons that you described. They want to make sure that people from the impacted community are able to benefit from this billion-dollar investment that's going to be coming to Buffalo.
They been able to, you talk about Syracuse, and I'm sure you're only somewhat familiar to it, but as best you understand, they've been able to successfully make that connection, or is that something that you don't totally know?
They have, and okay. I traveled to Syracuse in order to meet with folks there and actually observed their program and met with some of the students and met with the instructors, really immersed myself in it because, again, this is something we're taking very seriously and we're very committed to getting it up and running as quickly as possible. And it's highly successful because, you know, the companies, the contractors, the trades, they need people.
There's no doubt about that.
So if we can get them prepared to walk through the door and generally have some idea what they're doing, right? Like, they're not coming in totally green, totally fresh.
Right.
They've used hand tools, they've poured concrete, they've mixed asphalt, they've used power tools, they've been on some job sites. They're in good shape, right? Like that is...
So your program is going to offer that type of exposure?
That's the intention,
okay.
Yes. It's primarily an exposure program. There's some classroom components. We want folks to, you know, be competent in some construction math, to get OSHA 10 certified, so they have all of their safety certifications. A couple other classroom components that I'm not thinking of, but then in a workshop, getting familiar with hand tools, getting familiar with power tools, again, learning how to create concrete forms, mix concrete, pour concrete, same thing with asphalt. And then ideally, what they do in Syracuse is they have partnerships with, out there it's the municipal, one of their partners is the Municipal Housing Authority, and there's a housing development directly across the street from their workshop. So when the Housing Authority has jobs, especially related to concrete, pavement, things like that, they go over there and they either do it themselves or they assist. So they get that on-the-job training. We would want to do the same thing. And if we can't, if there's not jobs available, which is sometimes the case in Syracuse, you just do it in-house, right? You just do the best you can with in your own workshop, doing the same kind of jobs that you would do in a real job. But I don't think there's going to be any lack of opportunities for our students to get to job sites. So I think there's a hunger from the employers to have the type of students that we're going to train come into their workforce. And, you know, ultimately, I would hope, and I don't know, but I would hope that there's some incentives to, you know, make sure we know that there are MWBE requirements for state jobs.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, you got to have a certain amount of contractors who meet those requirements. I would hope that there, you know, at some point in the future, there's requirements for the employees that are working for those contractors as well, right? But we will be prepared to create trained students who are going to be able to fill those jobs.
Well, then the follow-up with this question then, and you actually touched upon it, but we didn't have a chance to get into it, then the same problem that, you know, these companies are having, getting employees, getting the message to the right people who have the right interest. How about from the EOC standpoint, how are you going to, you know, I mean, I'm sure you do this with all your programs, of course. How do you get the message to the right spot?
That's a great question. One of our strengths, right? Our strengths are our infrastructure. And our infrastructure is very strong in that foundational academic review, right? We've got instructors, we've got courses, we can help people, you know, increase their levels of competency in all the core subject areas. Another strength that we have in terms of infrastructure is our admissions and recruitment. We have an excellent admissions and recruitment team. Our admissions supervisor has been in the field for many, many years and has been in the Buffalo community doing admissions for other institutions. between him and myself, right? Like, so my background with Erie County, with the Mad Urban Center, I've worked with just scores and scores of nonprofit organizations and have developed relationships with, you know, the leadership and staff at many of those organizations. That's where the people are, right?
Right.
So we go to where the people are and help inform them on what opportunities we have. I don't work day to day in our admissions department, but what I do know is that we're not limited by their ability to recruit.
Hmm.
We're limited by our capacity to be able to provide programs for people to get involved in. Like, if I've got seats, if I've got new programs, like the ones that we're developing, and I've got seats for people to fill, I have the utmost confidence that our admissions department is able to fill those seats, because it kind of goes back to the essential nature of the EOC that I was describing. It's not... People are looking for the opportunities that we are able to provide. And if we get out there and we describe them and we connect with people and we make it easy for them to connect with us, our seats, our classes are full. That's the experience that I've had. So it's comforting as an executive director to know that if we can build new programs, then we will have people in those seats. That's how I approach it today, is with the confidence that we can fill the seats because of the experience that I've had with those folks and what I've seen them be able to deliver. But it just comes back to meeting people where they are. There's a place for advertising, there's a place for billboards and bus wraps and things like that. But if you go to where people are and you tell them what we have to offer and we make it easy for them to take advantage, it makes all the difference.
We're talking with Ben Hillegas today on what's next, the executive director of the EOC here in Buffalo. Really a fascinating conversation regarding the Kensington project, or mm-hmm. the potential Kensington project. We'll leave it at potential for the moment.
That's right.
But that's one very specific but very exciting opportunity. Maybe just talk about some other things that are developing as well that might help somebody else who is looking for a whole different path, because, you know, let's be honest, if everybody wanted to be in the trades, they wouldn't be looking workers right now, right?
I'd be remiss if I didn't add one more thing to the trades conversation before I move on, and it's a parallel thing that's happening. Another Syracuse program that's being replicated in Buffalo. In this case, it's not DOT, it's Empire State Development, replicating a program in Syracuse that is a trades pre-apprenticeship program and direct entry, right? So ESD is trying to replicate a program in Syracuse that they have funded out there that provides an exposure-based curriculum program to folks in a pre-apprenticeship setting. They learn everything that they need to know about all of the various trades, and then they are connected directly to the trade unions for apprenticeships. This involves, obviously, the trade unions being on board and invested and engaging, and their ESD has been very successful so far in getting the trade unions engaged and interested in doing this. So that is going to happen. The EOC is definitely going to be very involved in probably providing the pre-apprenticeship curriculum, but it's a very exciting, transformative opportunity for our community, and I just wanted to.
Yeah, no, it's. There. I mean, and it's interesting and again enlightening to hear, because, you know, we've been talking about the lack of workers and the jobs that are going to be there, whether because people are retiring or whatever the case may be, or the economy is expanding as we'd like to hope that it will continue to do so. But it is interesting to know that there are these state agencies that are actually doing real groundwork. It's not just a press conference and a couple of releases and put up a website.
Yeah, and I've been observing and witnessing and a part of the groundwork, and it's amazing to see, honestly. And just to your previous point,
so you really see people who are really analyzing the process and finding ways to do the job better.
We can't do direct entry pre-apprenticeship programs without the trade unions being on board. And,
right.
And you kind of indicated earlier that that's been challenging in the past, right? But the folks from Empire State Development have actually been successful in bringing them to the table. And I think it truly represents what could be a real paradigm shift in getting folks into apprenticeships and allowing them to have, you know, really, really family-sustaining, careers for the rest of their lives. And we're just thrilled to be a part of it. It's still in early stages, but it is based on Syracuse model that is successful. And I see a real commitment to it happening here. And the EOC is just thrilled to be a part of it.
All right, so we were ready to expand when we grabbed onto that into maybe just a couple of other partnerships.
Yep.
or programs that you see changing that might offer a whole different type of a perspective here.
So I'm very happy to have the opportunity to kind of shout out some of the partners that we've been working with. ECC, SUNY Erie, has been a tremendous partner, and Dr. Sagai, the president, has been a great ally and someone who has a real commitment to finding ways for the EOC and the community college to work together, developing pathways in allied health fields and possibly technology. So we have ongoing conversations, but that would also kind of represent a paradigm shift, because what we're talking about is the potential opportunity for students to take classes at the EOC for free, right? That could be credit bearing at SUNY Erie or another SUNY institution, right? So that's unique. That's not something that happens very often.
Okay.
And then also, you know, many people go to a community college and are not prepared to take the 101 level courses,
sure.
Right?
Yep.
And in some cases, they end up taking remedial courses and they're using financial aid in order to pay for those things. And there's a limit to how much financial aid you get over the course of your lifetime.
Right.
So you're kind of burning through the resources that you have available in order to get to the beginning. But the EOC can do those same things for free at the EOC. So we can develop pathways where folks are taking those remedial, and I don't like that word, but I don't have a better one.
Understood.
Right.
But yeah, but the things that you need to enter and get into regular college.
And we can do it in an intentional way where we know that what they're taking is going to prepare them for what they need to do at ECC by having those conversations and planning in advance. So that's something we're very excited about and continuing to develop what that will look like. But it will happen.
And that will do it for Producers Picks. We thank our guests, Kathleen Rizzo-Young, Trina Burris, and Ben Hillegas. If you missed anything or you want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcast or on the Amplify BTPM app. Each episode is also online at wbfo.org. I'm Dallas Taylor, and thank you for listening.